Highland Falls, El Paso, Clarksville, Watertown, and from other important military capitals around the globe, Eye on Defense brings the top military and defense issues into focus. Eye on Defense is proudly sponsored by Big Sarge Pre-Owned TA-50 Emporium and The Last Hope Jewelry and Pawn. And now, citizens of Earth, brace yourselves for the next episode of Eye on Defense. Defense, 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 defense.
All right, we're back, everybody. It's episode 266. This is 3 May. Rare episode that I do in the daytime. Usually I do them at night. I have more energy at night, blah, blah, blah. But I'm doing one of the day today. And I won't keep you long because I got to get to work. So it'll be a short episode, I think. I usually say that and then I'll go more than 30 minutes. But I think it'll be short. How many stories? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Not too bad. We'll start off. No word on Rafah. What's going on with the IDF in Rafah? No word on the hostage deal. But there is an interesting article from Yonah Jeremy Bob, Jerusalem Post, yesterday. Mossad, Shin Bet, and IDF Intel issue group message for the first time since 7 October. I'll get right into it. Mossad Director David Barnot, Shin Bet Director Ronan Barr. We hear about those guys all the time with the hostage stuff. An outgoing IDF Intelligence Chief Major General Haliva on Thursday, a couple days ago, yesterday, effectively issued their first unified public message since 7 October. All three agencies provided an unusual update on their work via the Journal of Israeli Intelligence and Heritage Commemoration Center, IICC. The Mossad wrote that its contribution to the war effort, not only in a general sense, but giving specific examples, including the Hamas-made robots that helped the IDF penetrate and analyze Hamas tunnels in Gaza. Further, the spy agency's technical prowess has helped the IDF learn new methods of operating in nighttime battle situations and how to use artificial intelligence to analyze and select optimal battle strategies and options. We talked about this many, many months ago. I don't know if it was many, many months ago. It was months ago. About how the IDF was clearing urban structures above ground and underneath in tunnels at the same time, something probably no one's ever done before. So they definitely, the IDF and Mossad's got their stuff together there. Further, the spy agency's technical, I already read that. In addition, the Mossad wrote about its contribution to negotiations that led to the return of more than 80 hostages in November. The article by the Mossad described Barno's negotiations with the CIA Director William Burns and top Qatari and Egyptian officials. From the U.S. side, William Burns is the bag man, right, for the president. So wherever he goes, something's going on. That's not in the article. Let's talk about Shin Bet. Shin Bet said had given the entire defense apparatus crucial intelligence on how to defang and take apart Hamas within the early hours of the war as it started to take into custody and interrogate Hamas captives. They probably got a lot of stuff from those captives, especially after a 7 October failure of the entire Israeli defense establishment. It was the moment that returned some of the dignity and confidence into the system. The IDF intelligence article focused on how the apparatus evolved after failures to get intelligence to operational units in real time during the second intifada into the 2000s and the second Lebanon War of 2006. According to IDF intelligence, transformations made it ready to provide real-time intelligence to soldiers on the front via electronic interconnectedness and units 8200, 504, and 9900, officers serving near the front. I guess those units, unit 8200, unit 504, and unit 9900 are like intel units. Moreover, IDF intelligence said it hit new highs on the volume and quality of intelligence targets that it now provides to operational units on a daily basis. Last paragraph. The article gave little specifics about the failures of 7 October other than to admit to them and say all organizations are reviewing issues for internal probes. End of article. Very nice little short article, but a lot of information there. Next, we'll go to Ukraine. French President Macron says, talking about sending troops to Ukraine again. Macron said he would consider sending troops to Ukraine in case of Russian breakthrough Ukrainian requests. This is from Kiev Post, I think. I'm sorry, I thought it was the Kiev Post. Nate Osteller and the Kiev Independent News Desk, 2 May, yesterday. French President Macron said he would consider sending troops to Ukraine in the case of a Russian breakthrough at the front, or if Ukraine has requested it, had requested it. This is an interview he did with The Economist on 2 May, yesterday. President Macron said such conditions did not currently exist. Way back in March, President Macron called for the Russian invasion, called the Russian invasion of Ukraine existential. That's a hard word to say. Existential for France and the rest of Europe. Later, President Macron said he would not rule out the possibility of sending Western troops to Ukraine. Of course, we talked about that way back in March. Everybody was pissed. And that's a crude way to put it, but people were upset. I think the Germans were upset. I think the Americans were upset. Anyway, moving on. President Macron reiterated this sentiment during an interview with The Economist, saying that Europe's basic condition of security depends on its ability to avoid defining concrete red lines. So he wants to define concrete red lines. And I guess there is one that if Russia wins in Ukraine, there will be no security in Europe, he said. Kiev has not appealed to the West to send troops to Ukraine, instead asking for increased arms supplies to help Ukrainian soldiers fend off Russian aggression. In a novel comparison, President Macron said France had sent troops to aid African nations in the Sahel when they had requested for help. The French president also said that Europe cannot always rely on the United States for defense and must learn to get ready to protect ourselves. The interview came ahead of a visit to France by President Xi Jinping in May. Macron is expected to try and convince Xi to use his influence over Russian President Putin to seek an end to the full-scale war in Ukraine. In recent months, Macron has been increasingly outspoken advocate of European defense, championing increased defense production and military aid for Ukraine. So there you go. I don't know what he's talking about. Is he going to send the French Foreign Legion in? Maybe. Who knows? While we're talking about Ukraine, we just did a story about Russia said they shot down 6 attackums. They claimed that. Well, here's another story that's been floating around. This is from 2 May about Ukraine striking Russia with those attackums. There's video of some troop. Look, I don't have the best eyes in the world. It looked like some troop concentrations were getting blasted. You can look at the video yourself. But this is from 2 May, Inderbish Defense Post. Ukraine strikes major Russian troop concentration with attackums. Videos emerged on social media of a purported missile strike on a concentration of Russian troops in occupied Luhansk. A volley of 4 missiles allegedly struck a Russian military training and coordination center in about 90 seconds, over 90 seconds. The site was geolocated around 78 kilometers or 48 miles from the front line, near the town of Kuban, K-U-B-A-N. The timing is unknown, but multiple media outlets suggested it occurred recently. Captured by a drone camera, the roughly 6 minutes of footage shows the first of 3 explosions at the 4-minute mark, around 10 seconds after a dud or spent dispenser landed in the area. A blast was then followed by a plume of smoke from detonating submunitions. A little less than 90 seconds later, another explosion takes place a short distance away, followed by another seconds later. Let's talk about the TACMs, or the author does. He says the first tranche of 20 short-range variant TACMs were delivered to Ukraine in October of last year. They're capable of striking 165 kilometers away. I think those are the cluster ones that we talked about last episode. And then, of course, we know in March, the Biden administration sent some of the long-range ones, the 300-kilometer ones, the unitary warhead, I think they're called. Moving on. Ukraine forces struck Russian air bases in Berdansk and Luhansk with missiles in the same month. I think we'd covered that also. One of the first targets they used the attackums with was an airfield. A similar batch of longer-range variants arrived in March this year, quietly, and were used to strike a Russian-held Crimea Peninsula on 30 March. There's another possibility, too. Another possible missile Ukraine might have used in this strike is the Tachka-U SRBM, which I'd never heard of, which can be equipped with a cluster warhead and has a range of 120K. Here's some quotes from this Ukrainian military analyst. His name is Oleksandr Musenko. Mr. Musenko, I'm sorry if I murdered your name here. The target Russian troops were preparing for an attack on neighboring Kharkiv. It's, quote, is precisely in the territory of the northeastern part of Luhansk that Russia has been training and coordinating its units, which were specifically preparing for an escalation of hostilities in the Kharkiv region, where Russia plans to reinforce in its advance. Here's another quote. The goal is to slow down the enemy's offensive actions, not allowing them to deploy in the combat formations. The reason for the strike, I assume, while we wait for more advanced weaponry, it's crucial to use what we have, namely the ATACMS, to strike the enemy in their rear and prevent them from advancing to the front line, he concluded. So that's kind of like a part two of the story we did last episode about the six ATACMS, which Russia said they shot down. Anyway, a couple more stories. Now we're getting some domestic stuff here. Again, Defense Post. Quite a few Defense Post stories today. U.S. Army unveils new Bradley armored fighting vehicle variant. New variant of the Bradley, Juster Domingo 3 May. The U.S. Army has revealed a new variant of the Bradley tracked armored fighting vehicle. They call it the M2A4E1. It's touted as the vehicle's first modern and survivable version. It is integrated with the Iron Fist active protection system to detect and intercept incoming missiles and rockets using radar and infrared tractors and explosive projectiles. Iron Fist is what they're using. The vehicle is also equipped with an improved high-definition forward-looking infrared gunner sight and an environmental control unit to prevent heat stress. A statement from the Army's PEO, which is Program Executive Office, Ground System Combat Systems, said the force has already received funding to procure one M2A4E1 unit for even Ukraine. How about that? Of course, here's some background on the Bradley. Created transport infantry units while offering armor protection. Bradley vehicles are fitted with laminate and explosive reactive armor that can withstand RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades. They're equipped with a 25mm M242 Bushmaster autocannon, TOW anti-tank missiles, and a 7.62 M240 Charlie machine gun. The platform has seen plenty of use in Kiev as Ukraine deployed its Bradleys to counter Russian troops. Since last year, the United States has donated 186 Bradleys as part of military aid to Kiev. And that's it. Of course, everybody knows Bradley's a fantastic vehicle. The crews love the Bradleys. They've been around a long time. They're solid. The mechanics know how to fix them. So nothing wrong with the Bradley. Very, very well-respected vehicle. High soldier approval rate. Now we're talking about the Marine Corps. I guess they're amphibious Bradley because now they just put a 30mm cannon on one of the variants. U.S. chooses Kongsberg remote turret for the amphibious combat vehicle weaponry. This is a Marine effort. The amphibious combat vehicle, there's different variants. There's an assault variant that has a 30mm cannon. They just decided what it will be. Kongsberg Protector RT-20 remote turret has been installed on the representative test vehicle for the U.S. Marine Corps' amphibious combat vehicle 30mm cannon variant, the ACV-30. Kongsberg collaborated with ACV contractor BAE Systems to supply the vehicles with a turret that, quote, provides the lethality and protection Marines need while leaving ample room for troop capacity and payload. The RT-20 is said to eliminate space requirements of older turreted cannon systems, adding more room for troops and equipment while reducing weight for increased mobility. The Kongsberg Defense Land System Vice President Jorgen Bull explained that the collaboration provides necessary upgrade in the force's firepower vehicles and weapon systems. The ACV-30 variant program is scheduled for completion by July of 25, not too far away. The first 30 units were delivered to the Marine Corps in February. What is the ACV? It is developed to provide the Marines with a true open ocean and ship-to-objective capability for land and sea missions. I don't see how they get these suckers to float. There's different variants. It has a personnel variant, also known as the ACVP. It has a command variant, the ACVC, and a recovery variant, the ACVR. And, of course, I guess the assault variant, I don't know what they call it, ACV-30, the one with the cannon. These vehicles currently supplement the forces assault amphibious vehicle, AAV. They've been in service since 1972. The Marine Corps has announced that these older vehicles will eventually be phased out in favor of these ACVs. So there you go. AAV will be out. ACV will be in. While we're with the Marine Corps, we'll go to this one. I got two stories about that. So Marine Corps Commandant says the new amphib readiness memo will outlast him in the CNO. Justin Katz, 3 May. A recently signed classified document aimed at amphibious ship readiness will provide framework for the services to use moving forward. That the Marine Corps Commandant, Eric Smith, today, 3 May, said will outlast the tenure of him and Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Lisa Franchetti. Of course, Lisa Franchetti's in charge of the Navy and General Smith's in charge of the Marine Corps. Here's a quote from General Smith. Lisa Franchetti's signature is worth something. My signature is worth something. And Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro supports it. So it's worth something, he said. Well, it sounds like it's worth something. And when you see that visible signature, it's a reminder to all that it's all hands on deck time to get the amphibs ready. The two service chiefs in February signed a letter to their respective three-star officers ordering a deep dive on amphibious ship readiness. That letter also calls for the services to synchronize their understanding of the requirements for training and certification of amphibious ships and how to meet them. I think I commented on this a couple months ago or a month ago, episodes ago, whatever, that we're doing another study, right? That we need to get together and do another study on how to use the amphib ships. I think this is the memo that he's talking about, because the Marine Corps and the Navy forgot how to do that. I'm being funny. General Smith, as well as Assistant Commandant, now Commandant. Oh, General Smith, as the Assistant Commandant, now Commandant, got it. Because remember when he couldn't be the Commandant because the Senate couldn't confirm him because of all the nonsense going on that? Nobody remembers that. Anyway, General Smith has frequently pushed back against the public narrative that the Marine Corps and the Navy are at odds with one another over amphibious shipbuilding, and he highlighted the memo with the CNO as proof that the two services are in harmony. The narrative discontent within the Pentagon was pervasive last year as the Marine Corps brass publicly expressed displeasure with a strategic pause on amphibious shipbuilding in the FY24 budget, which we talked about. Asked why the new memorandum was necessary if the services are already in agreement. The Commandant told reporters, it just puts it on record. There you go. I'll stop right there. Let's go to the Sec Navy, see what he's got to say. So following new article, Justin Katz again, 1 May, following last year's terminal, Secretary of Navy says the Navy should have been buying amphibs sooner. So now the Sec Navy's like, oh, yeah, we should have been doing this the whole time. But then he defends the service's plan to pause amphibious shipbuilding during last year's budget cycle. So 1 minute, he's sending conflicting messages. 1 minute, we should have been buying them sooner. But then the next minute, he says, I defend our pause on amphibious shipbuilding. So what's the deal here? We'll find out. So following a year of tumult between the Navy, Marine Corps, and the broader Pentagon and numerous lawmakers over a proposed pause in amphibious shipbuilding, the service secretary today, Carlos Del Toro, told a congressional committee the Pentagon should have been replacing amphibious fleets sooner. I was before it before I was against it. There's no question in my mind that we should have been buying more amphibious ships earlier, Navy Secretary told House Armed Services Committee this morning during a hearing to review the FY25 budget request. His comment was in response to a question from Chairman Representative Mike Rogers, who noted the Navy was once able to maintain two heel-to-toe deployments of amphibious readiness groups simultaneously, but in recent years have struggled to upkeep just one. Let's see. Here's a quote from the Navy Secretary. Since 2017 and 2018, we've unquestionably been challenged by maintenance problems with our amphib ships. The age of our amphibious fleet is excessively high. We need to continue to invest in new ships to replace these old ships. The Secretary's acknowledgement follows last year's budget cycle, which was dominated by Navy proposal to implement a, quote, strategic pause on amphibious shipbuilding, citing a variety of factors such as cost and design. That proposal infuriated several lawmakers on Capitol Hill, such as Dan Sullivan, senator from Alaska, who personally accused Del Toro of flouting the law for presenting Congress with a shipbuilding plan that did not achieve 31 amphibious ships. We know that the Navy's all about it now, but apparently they wanted a pause back then. That decision also rankled, good word, pissed off, another good word, top Marine Corps brass, who made no qualms about publicly voicing their displeasure, despite insisting that Navy leadership was largely in agreement with them about the need for more amphibious ships. We never did figure out who the bad guy was in all this, right? Nobody knew who's the bad guy. The Navy wanted more amphib ships. The Marine Corps wanted more amphib ships. The lawmakers wanted more amphib ships. So who was this mysterious person behind the curtain, behind the scenes, not allowing more amphib ships? Nobody knows. But some reports suggest that the Office of Secretary of Defense, no name given, was largely behind the pause, but nevertheless, Del Toro was forced to defend the choice publicly to lawmakers. Previous statements aside, the service's shipbuilding plan this year does reach the amphibious ship fleet, and Del Toro suggested he was eager to replace the oldest ships in the inventory. So we never did figure out who the person behind the scenes was, not allowing amphibious ships to be built. But they've got it all squared away now. 21 minutes. Last story. Why do we need all these amphibious ships? I guess China. So here's a China story. China launches Pakistan's Hangor submarine despite engine row with Germany. Usman Ansari, 30 April, Defense News. This is kind of a tough article to get your head around. So China's building the submarine for Pakistan. The engine's made is a German engine, but Germany doesn't want to, has got a problem with China about the engine. So nobody knows what engine is in this submarine. Is it a German engine? Nobody knows. Or is it a Chinese engine based on a German copy or based on a German design? Stay tuned. The first of 8 Hangor submarines for Pakistan was recently launched at the Wuchang shipyard in Wuhan, China. Wuhan, China. Why does that sound familiar? That rings a bell somewhere. Anyway, though it's uncertain what could be powering the boat, given the German block on an engine export. The initial Hangor 2 delivery timeline would have seen the 4 Chinese-built submarines delivered in 2023, which is like last year, but Germany had refused to approve the export license for the MTU-396 diesel engine, which the submarine was designed to use. So remember that MTU-396 is a German engine. Germany doesn't want them to export it. This is not the first time. The German government had also declined export license for that engine in regard to Thailand's order of the S-26T, a variant of the Chinese 039B submarine. That deal eventually fell through. Thailand didn't want anything but the German engine. So neither Germany nor Pakistan have confirmed whether the export clearance was ultimately approved or denied for these Hangor 2 submarines, right? That's what we're talking about. The 8 Hangor 2 submarines launched in China, Wuhan, for Pakistan. We don't know what engine's in there. Germany won't say, Pakistan won't say. The Pakistan Navy did not respond to Defense News inquiry about whether Pakistan had accepted China's alternative proposal, which would have seen the locally made CHD-620 engines power the Hangar 2. So I think that's the Chinese variant of that German engine. Still, Pakistan's Naval Chief Admiral Ashraf attended the 26th launch ceremony and expressed satisfaction on the project's progress. The service is undergoing comprehensive modernization. The Navy, the Pakistan Navy, having acquired 4 Chinese-built Type 054 frigates that are the most powerful and capable service combatants it's ever operated. But it's the Hangar 2 submarines that will provide the Navy with a significant leap in capability. That's according to this guy named Tom Waldron, Navy analyst at a think tank. Here's a quote from him. Pakistan has reportedly tested sub-launched nuclear-capable cruise missiles, and the introduction of these submarines into the service will be far more significant of a handful of new frigates. This expert, Wadlin, is unsure about the engine. Another expert told Defense News that the Chinese alternative might negatively impact the operational effect of the submarines. Though this Chinese engine is a copy of the MTU-396, the Chinese variant is made with inferior cast and shape materials. It's assembled with inconsistent quality control standards and works great for a short period of time, then requires near continuous repair after a few hundred hours of operation. So it doesn't sound like it's very good. Pakistan naval officials previously told Defense News that the Hangor 2 submarine is a Pakistan service-specific variant of the Type 093 Bravo. It is equipped with a Stirling air-independent propulsion system to increase underwater endurance. And I'll stop there. That's it. So how many are there? 8 submarines going to Pakistan. Engine type unknown. 26 minutes. That's enough. I'll stop there. A little bit longer than I wanted to do. But anyway, a rare occasion, a rare daylight episode from Eye on Defense Podcast. Episode 22, what are we on? 266 is in the books. Thank you very much for listening and good night or good day.